Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. The man accused of shooting two Manchester police officers last week was in court this week. Ian McPherson faces life in prison, though his father says what he really needs is mental health treatment.
He's been suffering from mental illness issues for a long, long time. Hopefully he's going to get help with that. And we're going to be there for him the whole time.
New Hampshire officials at every level of government continue to press for more action to address opioid abuse. On Capitol Hill, Senator Gene Shaheen told colleagues that if the Senate can fund the fight against Zika virus, it can also do more about addiction.
In 2014, 47,000 Americans died from drug overdoses. And each day we wait, another 120 people die of drug overdoses. We're losing one person a day in New Hampshire.
Meanwhile, the presidential race continues to play a role in New Hampshire politics. Speaking on NHBR's Morning Edition, Republican U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte outlined what she'd like to hear from her party's likely nominee, Donald Trump.
I would certainly like him to speak in ways that is more inclusive, and I believe that's important. And I hope that he will surround himself with knowledgeable people on important issues like foreign policy. And to me, that's important for any candidate for president.
It's our weekly news roundup on The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Hi, Trent.
Hello.
Casey McDermott is here, NHPR's digital reporter. Hi, Casey.
Good morning, Brady.
And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Hi, Dean.
Good morning, Brady.
It's hard to believe it was almost exactly a week ago that residents of West Manchester woke up to the sights and sounds of gunshots, a heavy police presence, and a shelter-in-place order for part of the day. And this past week, we've been learning more about the man accused of shooting the two police officers. Ian McPherson was in court this week. Trent, what have we learned about him over the past week?
Sure. And just to sort of recap, Ian McPherson is charged with two counts of attempted capital murder for shooting two Manchester police officers a week ago from today. And in the last week, we've really spent a lot of time digging into his history. The day after the shooting, we spoke to his family and his father, as you could hear from the clip, said that he's really been challenged with mental health issues. He spent time in several mental health facilities. And so we said, well, how is it possible that someone who has spent time is open about having mental health issues? How was he able to legally purchase a gun? And he was able to legally purchase this .40 caliber Smith & Wesson. And what we found out was that New Hampshire does not submit names to this. There's a national checklist of people who cannot buy guns, and New Hampshire does not submit names of the term as mentally defective people to this list. And so Ian McPherson was able to get a gun. The other thing that we found out that was really interesting was that when he originally went to go purchase this gun, his background check didn't originally come back. And so he had to come back several days later. And what we found out is that you can go purchase a gun. There's a gun line, a state police gun line, that's staffed almost 365 days a year, where the gun store will call this gun line and say, I have this person, this is their social security number, here's what they say on their application. And then that state police gun line will call the store back, usually within 15 minutes.
So it's usually a quick process.
Usually it's 15 minutes. Not in this case. In McPherson's case, he had to come back several days later. And what we found out is that the gun store, if your background check doesn't come back, after 3 days, they can make the decision whether or not to sell the gun to you. They'll continue to investigate whether or not you lied on your application, or whether or not you were allowed to have that gun, and they'll refer that to local police or ATF. But in this case, what we found out was that he was not approved in 15 minutes, that he had to come back several days later. And what we still don't know is whether or not police were investigating whether or not he was allowed to have this gun.
Because, Casey, we know that that among Ian McPherson's history, there have been some he spent some time in mental hospitals, and there had been a charge of domestic violence, I believe, against his father at one point.
Yeah, and he was deemed competent to stand trial in a 2012 case, and wasn't committed to a mental institution in that case. But one of the things with regard to his specific case, some New Hampshire officials are saying they're not sure whether he would have met that federal definition that Trent was referencing to. So it's unclear whether or not he would have been flagged had New Hampshire run that kind of a check. But it is interesting because this is touching on a debate that has obviously been ongoing in New Hampshire and around the nation for a while. And there's a lot of back and forth. But you hear from, gun control advocates who are saying this is, and even Ian McPherson's own father saying that if he was allowed to buy a gun, this shows, gaps in the system. He should not have been allowed to buy this. At the same time, there are others who are saying, we need to make sure that we're using, we're using kind of rational judgment here. And you had the head of the National Alliance for Mental Illness in New Hampshire saying that, just because someone is mentally ill or has mental health issues doesn't mean that he or she is inherently dangerous. And we have to be careful about the kind of, stereotypes that we're promoting in these conversations.
One of the items in the Union Leader reporting that struck me the most, Trent, was a quote from McPherson's father, who said that I think the standard that the federal government uses is that if someone is involuntarily committed for at least 10 days, then that would trigger their name ending up on that federal gun registry. And McPherson's father said something like, well, he could have been committed to 10 days or even more, but the case wasn't necessarily that he was cured, but that there simply weren't enough beds in that case for him to stay on.
Yeah, and the McPherson family is, their story is incredibly powerful, and we've spoken to them several times since this came out, but that's what the dad says. We talked to the attorney general who said, to be on this list, and the quote is mentally defective, you have to be committed for 10 days. But McPherson's dad said that his son spent about 3 days in the state hospital, should have stayed for much longer, but they told the family that there were no beds available. And what's interesting here is that we're the only state left in New England not on this list. We're the only state that doesn't add names to this list. When other states in New England started adding names, almost 12,000 people were added to the list of people who can't buy guns. I think it's going to be an ongoing debate here.
And we heard this week from Governor Maggie Hassan. She was asked about whether New Hampshire should start sharing mental health information with the FBI's background check system. And here's what she had to say.
I think this issue needs to be looked at by a broad coalition of stakeholders. And that is certainly one of the questions that they should address. I think we should work together to take steps forward to improve the public safety and public health of New Hampshire by addressing this issue.
That's Governor Hassan speaking about whether the state should add the names of people with serious mental illness to the federal background check system. And a spokesperson later then said, Dean, that the governor does in fact favor New Hampshire providing that information to the federal government. But I mean, just coming back to this idea of the term mentally defective, it's one of the many examples of how people might say, well, why can't we simply do X? And often the answer is that it's much more complicated than it might appear at the surface.
Yeah, it is a complex issue. And as Casey mentioned, this is something we've been talking about for a while. The state legislature debated legislation to link New Hampshire to the FBI national database in 2014, but that never made it out of the state legislature. It's just a complicated issue because, you know, there are concerns about the stigmatizing mental illness. People were concerned about, you know, invasion of privacy, you know, and the issue of, you know, people recover from mental illness, and then if they're on this national checklist, how do they get back off of it? And what's so interesting to me is, you know, that this is – it's kind of an interesting split among conservatives, because some conservatives point to mental health whenever we talk about gun control, that this is a mental health issue, not a gun issue. But then there are others who see this as a privacy issue, which is also kind of a sort of a conservative or libertarian notion. So it's very complicated. Anytime you're talking about privacy rights public stigma, et cetera, it's problematic and difficult to legislate. And as we saw, you know, there are some types of crimes or behaviors that trigger denial of a gun permit. And apparently this, family domestic violence issue with his father didn't rise to that level. So it's a very complicated issue. The whole larger context of the gun debate and how it interacts with mental illness has just been kind of a perfect case for seeing all the sort of the complications with the issue.
So just to come back to something you said a moment ago, that
sure.
Because the case of domestic violence was between a father and son and not a partner case of domestic violence, then that is what didn't trigger the flag.
Right. As I understand the law, there are a list of things that you might be convicted of or charged with that would lead to a denial of the gun permit. This particular type of family domestic violence is not one of them, as I understand it.
One more note about this case before we move on to the rest of the week's New Hampshire news, Trent. Among those on hand for the court hearing this week for Ian McPherson were a number of Manchester police officers, including, I believe, both of the officers who were wounded last week.
Not only both of the officers who were wounded last week, but an officer who was wounded several years ago, also on the west side, very close to where this most recent shooting happened. The police chief in Manchester, Nick Willard, has now seen four of his officers shot in the line of duty. And I think what you've seen with the Manchester Police Department is that they've really come together. And so at that hearing, both of the officers who were shot were there. One was shot in the calf and he was on crutches. The other was shot in the cheek and he had a patch over his face. But they were there and the room was packed with uniformed officers.
And the press.
And the press.
And the press, certainly. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson. Today, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. And you can join us with your comments and questions about the news of the week at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. The issue of opioids is an ongoing one. We've talked about it on this program many times. And this week, both state and federal lawmakers were working on bills to deal with substance abuse, addiction, and treatment. So, Casey, let's start on Capitol Hill. The U.S. Senate passed a bill to provide some more resources and such for opioid addiction, the final vote being 94-1. But New Hampshire's U.S. senators had hoped for some additional funding in this measure, right?
Right. So Senator Jeanne Shaheen has been leading the charge, asking for about $600 million in emergency supplemental funding for a variety of Department of Justice, Department of Health and Human Services programs aimed at combating opioid abuse and opioid addiction. Senator Ayotte has also voiced support for this measure as well. And one of the issues that Senator Shaheen has brought up is that, you know, some of her colleagues say they want to just go about distributing this money through the normal budget process. She's saying, you know, the time is now. We have people dying every day in New Hampshire, all across the nation. So the Senate actually passed, as you said, a separate opioid bill earlier this week. But Senator Shaheen kind of stood up and said, you know, the time is now. We really need to act to distribute this other money that will really kind of help us move forward in a meaningful way to prevent more deaths.
Because of the way that things work on Capitol Hill, there's, I think, $725 million that this bill on recovery and addiction would authorize. But the money itself hasn't been authorized because that's part of the regular budget process.
Right.
And so
isn't that an interesting way that Washington works? They say, hey, we have an emergency here. Here's $725 million that we're going to allocate, but we're not actually going to spend.
Now, that legislation is now moving to the U.S. House. Meanwhile, here in New Hampshire, Trent, the Senate has just approved a bill to establish drug courts in every county. There have been drug courts in some parts of the state, and now it looks like there may be drug courts in every part of the state.
There will be drug courts in every part of the state, and that was a very important thing, especially in Hillsborough County, where Manchester and some other towns that are really struggling with this. You know, the mayor of Manchester said, we need a drug court. And he went to his county delegation to try and get a drug court. But they said, you know what? The state really needs to deal with this. And finally, the state came up with a comprehensive plan that will work for all the counties. And I expect the governor to sign that probably today, sometime this week or next week.
Meanwhile, the Senate also passed a bill aimed at stopping drugs from getting into prisons. And the Senate bill would use body scanners. Dean, there was some debate over the proposed solution, but there's little to no argument that there's actually a problem in the state's prisons.
Yeah, there's a concern that increasingly people in state prisons are being found with drugs. We had the situation several weeks ago or so where the gentleman who was in custody actually died in the jail from I think he had some
fentanyl.
Sort of an fentanyl overdose, right? So clearly stuff is getting into jails and prisons, and this would be sort of one way to better track that and keep it out.
You hear these stories about envelopes being laced with different things or different
people
things that
creative.
Wind up getting in.
Yes,
you know, people seem to find a way.
We've spoken to inmates who say it's actually easier to get drugs in county jails here in New Hampshire than on the street. The only problem is it's 10 times more expensive.
And, of course, this bill would try to put – it's about $1 million for 6 scanners at the existing men's prison in Concord, the prison in Berlin, and then the new women's prison when it opens in Concord. And then there would also be about the same amount of money in grants for county jails to try to purchase scanners. But as I understand it, Trent, the opposition comes in from people who are saying, well, we don't know that this is necessarily the most effective or cost-effective way to deal with this particular issue.
Right. Even prison officials are saying that. They're saying, you know, we don't necessarily think that this is the best way to do it.
Senate Democrats put out a press release saying that they were pushing Casey for a committee of conference to try to work on the plan more. It doesn't look like they got that. But
yeah, not at this point. Right now, the Senate did pass the legislation yesterday. It's unclear right now what Governor Hassan might do with it once it makes it to her desk. But they were pretty vocal in voicing the concerns that you mentioned, both in terms of cost effectiveness and whether this is actually going to root out the problem.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners now. Jan is calling from Dover. Hi, Jan. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I'm responding to the horrible story regarding the two policemen who were shot in the line of duty last week, and wanted to say that my husband, as a state legislator, has heard numerous stories from police in which they are lamenting the kind of lack of community support and respect for the job that they do. And I think that that horrific penalties are not, for harming a policeman are not an avenue to go. I think that our supporting police in very concrete ways in terms of more dialogue with the policemen on their beats, offering thank yous and paying them decent salaries.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jan.
And I don't have a policeman in my family. I just happen to enjoy living in a city which has an excellent police force.
Well, thank you.
And I know it's not the only excellent police force in the state.
Well, thank you so much for the call and the comment. Dean, it comes back a bit to what you were saying before, that there's so many different issues people talk about. Does the state offer enough in the way of mental health resources? And we've seen in the city of Manchester from time to time people saying, well, the police department has asked for more officers and doesn't necessarily always have the number that it says it needs. And, you know, you can sometimes see some of those issues playing back out.
Yeah, you know, the Jan raises a number of issues that are all interlinked. On the, you know, as we were saying earlier, on the background checked issue, it's just sort of the reality of in New Hampshire, this whole issue of mental health and gun regulation runs into a very strong tradition of Second Amendment rights and privacy rights in the state. So that's, I think that's part of the issue. But you know, there, not only in New Hampshire but around the country, there's been an ongoing dialogue about how to kind of have, you know, better community relations between the police and citizens, and making sure there's the appropriate type of resources that police need to get the job done. But yeah, it's a very difficult issue, and I'm sure we haven't heard the last of it.
No doubt about that. We'll take more of your comments and questions as we look at the week's New Hampshire news. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. We're looking at some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and as always, you can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University and nhpoliticalcapital.com, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and NHPR's digital reporter Casey McDermott. We were talking a moment ago about opioids and a number of the issues that have been coming up there. Casey, the state had some grant money for treating pregnant women and mothers with addiction issues, but this week the Concord Monitor reported the Department of Health and Human Services hadn't awarded any of that money. Why not?
So just for a little bit of background, the Concord Monitor had a pretty in-depth piece on this issue earlier this week. And as they reported there, the state had proposed a grant last year specifically aimed at funding more treatment options for low-income pregnant women, parenting moms who are at risk of becoming homeless and who are addicted to drugs. But in the end, the Department of Health and Human Services hasn't actually awarded any of that money, even though they had several, you know, programs across the state that have applied for those funds and were hopeful that they, you know, proposed things that met the criteria. But the state's saying that they didn't receive any grant proposals that did meet the criteria. So this is really an issue that I think a lot of people in the health community are mindful of. A lot of people in the addiction recovery community are mindful of, because this is an issue that affects not only the mothers who are addicted to drugs, but also the infants in many cases. The state is seeing a rise in what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is when a baby is born going through withdrawal, essentially, and that can have a lot of consequences for that infant as well as the mom. So there are a lot of efforts around the state to try to help that population in particular, and this was seemingly one of them that didn't end up panning out.
You know, what's interesting in the Monitor story, they had some, I think, very good facts that were really important. And what they said, what they reported, was that a few years ago in 2012, 2013, there was a survey that was done that said that about 10% of children living in New Hampshire live with someone struggling with drugs or alcohol. That number jumps to 17% for teenagers. And that was a few years ago. The national average is closer to 14%. But then they got some data from HHS, the Division of Children and Youth and Family Services, and they said that they've seen a nearly 50% increase in the number of cases of children who are being born to parents who are addicted to drugs. In 2013, it was 285 children who were born addicted to drugs. And in 2015, that jumped to 430. So a lot of really scary facts in that story.
And I've heard that from a number of nurses that I just know personally who've said it's astonishing how much they have seen of this happening. And it's important to keep in mind, these are the ones who are coming forward. There are other people, as the Monitor report noted, Casey, who are worried about coming forward. And that's another complicating factor in trying to reach out and get treatment for people who need it.
And I think that was part of the motivating factor for bringing forward this potential, you know, funding for programs like this and the other programs that are out there at other, you know, a number of hospitals. Concord Hospital, Dartmouth have similar kind of recovery programs aimed specifically at mothers. And one of the things that you hear from a lot of the medical providers there is that it's really important to just bring down that stigma, to not shame these women, because they're actually doing the right thing by coming forward and trying to get help for their infants. So as much as, you know, the community in the medical community and other support personnel can kind of make it okay for women to come forward with this. I think that there's a lot of consensus that that's the right thing to do.
As you mentioned, a number of centers had applied for this grant funding. Is there any chance that they might end up seeing it from the Department of Health and Human Services?
It's unclear right now. The Department of Health and Human Services spokesman said that the department's now kind of reassessing what they need to do to provide additional housing supports for women in this position, but there's not really a timeline in place for when that might happen.
Finally, on opioids, Trent, the Attorney General's office got approval this week from the Executive Council to continue an investigation into drug companies. What are they looking for?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. The Attorney General signed a contract with an outside law firm to help them potentially sue opioid manufacturers. These are legal opioid manufacturers. They want to see if they maybe didn't advertise correctly in New Hampshire, didn't warn people about some of the dangers of taking prescription painkillers. And so the Attorney General spent about $100,000 sought to spend about $100,000 to hire an outside law firm just to start the investigation. They're not talking about suing anyone yet. But they were actually turned down by a court. The court said, you know, you have to go through the legislative process to get this money. If the legislature or the executive council, if you want this to happen, you have to follow the right channels. And the Attorney General Joe Foster was successful. He was able to do that. And so now the state has $100,000 to begin the process of investigating legal prescription painkiller companies to see if they maybe didn't advertise correctly or didn't warn people about some of the dangers of taking prescription painkillers.
And that's something that's been going on in a number of other states as well. So certainly something we're going to be hearing plenty about. Speaking of litigation that involves multiple states, Dean, the long-running litigation over MTBE appears to have finally come to an end. What can you tell us about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week on the appeal that ExxonMobil had filed against the state?
You're right, Brady. This has been going on for a long time. It goes back to 2003 when the New Hampshire Attorney General sued 22 oil companies for using MTBE, which is this well-known gasoline additive that's put in gasoline to boost octane. And, you know, over the course of the last 13 years, all of the defendants settled with New Hampshire, I think, for a total of about $136 million, except for Exxon. Exxon wanted to go to trial. They argued that they were simply responding to a EPA or a government mandate on this issue. And there was, at the time that it was used, there was no awareness that this would be problematic as an additive. And so it went to trial in 2013. It was a three-month trial, the longest in the state history at the time. And they lost about a two-hour deliberation by the jury, and they were ordered to pay $236 million. So, they appealed to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court unanimously upheld the Superior Court ruling. They then asked the U.S. Supreme Court to hear this, the U.S. Supreme Court declined. You have to get a writ of certiorari to be considered by the Supreme Court. They denied that request, so they're not going to hear it. So now Exxon owes $236 million from the trial, plus interest, which is about $100 million. So we're looking at about a $336 million price tag for Exxon on this.
Coupled with the $136 million from the settlement with the other energy companies.
Money, yeah.
It's a lot of money. The state has been setting up infrastructure around what it's going to do with that money. There are now trust funds set up for it, although, of course, some of it is going to go to
lawyers
other purposes.
Some.
The lawyers will certainly get some. And then I read this week that about 10% by state law has to go to the state's rainy day fund. So that's not a small amount of money.
That's not a small amount of money. And the state's rainy day fund was already doing pretty well because if you remember back to the $1 billion Powerball, I mean, there was a lot of money going into state coffers from that. Business revenues are up after a business tax cut. And so the rainy day fund will be full.
Speaking of other contaminants in water, and it's perhaps not everybody's most exciting thing to be able to say there are multiple contaminants for New Hampshire water sources. But this week, Casey, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency announced a lifetime health advisory level for the types of chemicals that we've been talking about in parts of southern New Hampshire, like Merrimack and Litchfield, PFOA, and PFOS, which was found at the former Pease Air Force Base. Judging by the large number of press releases I got from state officials, this was welcome news.
Yeah, this is something that state officials both at the state and congressional level have been calling for a while, particularly in light of those contamination issues that, have come up in, recent months, but also in light of the contamination that came up at the Peace Air Force or the former Peace Air Force base as well, because those chemicals were found there. But basically, these are chemicals, PFOA, PFOS, that have been used in nonstick cookware, things like that, for a while. And the EPA's guidance that came out this week is that there's an advisory level of 70 parts per trillion. So right now, this having that number in place allows the state to move forward with some emergency rulemaking to kind of, you know, address the levels that fall within that range. They were kind of waiting on more guidance from the federal government so that they knew kind of how to move forward on that. So regulators are, welcoming this as kind of something that will allow them to take a step forward in terms of addressing the issue.
Because as the state gets its own rules in place, then it can start to say to the companies believed to be at the source of the outbreak, it's your job to clean this up and to pay for the cleanup.
And a lot of the tests that that have come back so far on wells in New Hampshire are still below this level. There are a few that are higher. There are some that are significantly higher. But the majority of the tests that, have come back so far are below this level.
One thing we should also note that was interesting, speaking since you mentioned testing, Trent, was that WMUR is reporting that as the investigation continues, the state is running more and more tests, and there are only so many companies that run these kind of tests. So you start to worry about, will there be a backlog? Will you start to get test results back more slowly?
There, and that's something that we've been reporting on the entire since this started, is that these tests are incredibly expensive, up hundreds of dollars potentially per
test. Just for each one, right.
For each test, and they're testing hundreds. I mean, 400 or 500 different different sites. And there are only there's only a handful of businesses in the country that do these. And the state is paying, HHS is paying for expedited tests. So they're even more expensive, but they still can take weeks to come back. And, you know, if there are taxpayers listening, you should know that HHS is keeping tabs on how much money that they've spent on all these tests, which will probably reach into the tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they are going to look to get that money
with
back
an eye to recoup it. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're looking back at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. You can join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Exchange at nhpr.org is where you can send your comments and questions by email or get in touch with us through Facebook and Twitter. This week, there was controversy at Dartmouth College following a display about police killed in the line of duty. Joining us now with more on that issue is Rob Wolf, who reported on it for the Valley News. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is National Police Week, so it's not necessarily a surprise that you would have a display about law enforcement. But who put up this particular display at Dartmouth, and why was it that there was controversy?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, National Police Week, for this event, the Dartmouth College Republicans, a student group, sought and obtained college officials' approval to put up a bulletin board that included statistics of numbers of police killed on duty in the student center. But also, they included the slogan, Blue Lives Matter. And I think that's probably what sparked the controversy. There's a very active Black Lives Matter movement on campus. And of course, many people know that that is a protest movement against police brutality. And so the Republicans put up this display at night. The following morning, it went down. It had been torn down and replaced by posters that said, you cannot co-opt the movement against state violence to memorialize its perpetrators. And then under that, it had a hashtag, Black Lives Matter. And so the members of this group claimed responsibility, and they said the reason they had done this was that it subverted not only their name, it was a play on their name, but it subverted their message and sort of turned it on its head.
This comes back to something that you often hear from members of the Black Lives Matter movement, is the idea that if someone were to say that all lives matter, for example, is something you sometimes hear, that they're saying that that waters down the idea that we're speaking about a particular number of issues involving people of color, either on campus or just in their relations with law enforcement. And so it sounds like this particular set of people in the Dartmouth community saw the Blue Lives Matter message as a provocation.
They did indeed. But the Republicans saw it as a provocation in turn, And in fact, they saw it as a violation of their free speech. And the college president, his name is Phil Hanlon, he agreed. He called it an unacceptable violation of freedom of expression on our campus. That's from a statement that he sent out on Sunday. And in fact, he actually promised punishment for anybody who had acted related to this in violation of the college's standards of conduct.
Now, as you mentioned, there's an active group of Black Lives Matter activists on Dartmouth campus. So this isn't really new territory necessarily for the community. This is something that will often, I don't want to say flare up, but it was something that comes up regularly in Dartmouth.
It does. This follows the most recent and notable event was a large protest in November in the main campus library, Baker Berry. That also involved Black Lives Matter activists. It got acrimonious. It got covered by many media outlets, national ones. And Hanlon also weighed in on this one, and he also said that anybody found in violation of the college's standards would be punished. Though since then, they have declined to. They say they haven't found evidence that anybody has been.
Rob Wolf, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Rob Wolf, who's been reporting for the Valley News on the Blue Lives Matter display at Dartmouth College and the reaction to that from the Black Lives Matter movement on campus. Dean Spiliotis, I just wanted to ask you about this because as someone who'd spent some time at Dartmouth, you're not terribly surprised, I suppose, to hear that this is something that has been going on campus for some time.
Yeah, I did teach at Dartmouth for many years, but I've also been a member of a number of other university communities throughout my career. And wherever I am, you can pretty much count on something going on campus that is a reflection of kind of larger debates and the discourse around the country. So, you know, in this, these kinds of conflicts typically get into issues of, as we saw, free speech. As we just heard, the Dartmouth president has said, you know, he considers this a violation of free speech and also an act of vandalism. So, you know, these debates are very passionate. You know, students are really committed to their particular points of views. And, you know, we always like to talk about it being a sort of a teaching moment or a teaching opportunity. And, you know, most campus communities, Dartmouth included, try to use these moments to sort of address whatever the underlying conflict is. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, for me, going back 20, even 30 years to when I was a grad student, these kinds of things always roil campus communities. And it's an opportunity to explore a little more deeply, you know, a lot of these kinds of issues.
And that can even be problematic just in its own right. I'm thinking of something that Rob noted in one of his pieces about this week's events at Dartmouth. He talked with a number of students of color on the campus who said they were basically reluctant to talk to reporters. They were just concerned that when you speak up about something like this, is very easily the conversation winds up sort of adding fuel to the fire, whether or not individuals want it to be that way. And so it can wind up making a difficult issue even almost more difficult.
Absolutely. And then you sort of wrap in kind of the social media and kind of the instantaneous nature of communications now. And it really sort of whatever happens in a particular community often very quickly kind of goes beyond that community. We've seen that time and again in recent years, where it sort of suddenly becomes part of a larger national conversation.
And here we're in May, you know, we'd think we'd just be talking about college commencement season, and yet it doesn't seem to be working out quite that way, Trent.
That's right. Yeah, college commencement season underway. But, you know, what's interesting about this is how quickly it got picked up all across the country. You know, this Dartmouth story is, you know, look, Dartmouth is a beautiful place, but it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. And this story really got legs and was picked up all across the country.
Coming up after a short break, we'll take a look at some more of the week's news. We'll take a look at some news in the world of politics. WBUR took a poll of likely New Hampshire voters recently, and it had some interesting things to say both about the presidential race playing out in the Granite State and also how the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Republican Kelly Ayotte and Democratic challenger Maggie Hassan might play out in the fall. We'll have more on that. I'll also take more of your comments and questions about the news stories you've been following in New Hampshire this week. The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State news stories of the week, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. With us for the hour, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Casey McDermott, NHPR's digital reporter, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University and nhpoliticalcapital.com. Let's look at some political news of the week. I mentioned earlier that WBUR took a poll of likely New Hampshire voters. Casey, what did it say first about the presidential race in this state?
Well, first of all, this is according to one of the pollsters behind it, Steve Cazella with Mass Inc. Polling. He talked to NHPR's Peter Biello earlier this week just to give some additional context on the poll. But one of the takeaways is that neither Trump nor Clinton are particularly popular in New Hampshire. Both have higher unfavorable ratings right now than they do favorability ratings. Clinton's is at about 35 favorability to 58% unfavorable. Trump is at about 33 to 58. But despite that, looking at a potential general election matchup between the two of them, Clinton holds a slight lead right now, but it's still pretty narrow. And one of the other interesting things that I think the poll hit on, which is definitely a subject of conversation if you are on the receiving end of press releases from either of the state parties right now, is kind of the implications for a Trump or Clinton nomination on the U.S. Senate race. You know, obviously, Republicans trying to tie Hassan into Clinton, Democrats trying very hard to link Senator Kelly Ayotte to Donald Trump. But looking at that, Steve Cazella said there's not really enough evidence right now to say that Ayotte is necessarily being hurt by Trump, which I think is kind of interesting given the, you know, hype around her saying that she'll support him but not endorse him and kind of parsing words on that. But right now, at least according to this particular snapshot at this point in time, it doesn't seem like he is necessarily going to drag her down.
So, Dean, after all of the rhetoric about, you know, what Donald Trump would be like as a likely Republican nominee and what that might mean for Democrats and what it might mean for down ticket races, here we have at least one poll. It's one poll.
Sure.
But one that looks a lot like a general election New Hampshire poll that we'd see 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago. I mean, it's, you know, New Hampshire being that sort of potentially swing state again.
Right. And of course, Bernie Sanders supporters will point to the same poll and say, you know, his unfavorability is only 34% instead of 58% like the others. And he beats Trump by about 16 points. So they see that as further evidence of Bernie's viability. And it also makes you wonder, you know, as there's sort of a theory out there that some Sanders voters would actually vote for Trump over Clinton, you know, maybe that's being picked up as well in the margins. I don't know for sure. Aside about this Senate race, you know, we talk about, Republicans trying to link Maggie Hassan to Hillary Clinton and Democrats trying to link Kelly Ayotte to Donald Trump. Kelly Ayotte has worked very hard to kind of distance herself from Donald Trump with this famous comment now, you know, nationally famous comment now about supporting but not endorsing. Governor Hassan, however, is very different. I had an opportunity to interview her last week, and you can find a link to my interview on my website. She very closely tied herself to Hillary Clinton. I asked her, how do you feel about Clinton's kind of high unfavorability and issues with trustworthiness? And she gave an extended answer in which she was sort of very strongly defended Hillary Clinton. So she has sort of staked her claim with the Clintons. She's been an associate of theirs for a number of years. And so she's not backing away from that. And that's kind of a fundamental difference, I think, between how the two candidates are going to deal with the top of the ticket, should it be Clinton versus Trump.
And I want to come back to that U.S. Senate race in just a moment. But one more note on this poll, Trent, which I thought was interesting. They looked at a potential third-party run. In this case, they put in the name Mitt Romney. And the numbers were pretty interesting, although we should point out that the theory and the practice of third-party presidential campaigns are usually very different. So we keep that in mind as we parse through that part of the data.
Look, here's the thing about this poll, right? This poll is 6 months out. The election is 6 months out. It's a snapshot, as Casey said. All of the major candidates are within the margin of error. So the poll doesn't – top level, the poll doesn't really tell us all that much. It says, look, there are 10 to 15% of people who are undecided. These are the people who are going to decide the race. We knew that, right? We know that there are people who support Hillary Clinton and will continue to support her. We know there are people who support Donald Trump and will continue to support him. But there are a couple of real gems in this report, and Mitt Romney is one of them. So what they see is that what they found was that Mitt Romney is actually more favorable than Donald Trump here in New Hampshire. Donald Trump, Mitt Romney, I should say, has 32% of people who say they like him, and 52% of people who say they don't like him. 58% of people said they don't like Donald Trump. And then there were a couple of other really interesting things. If you really dig deep down into the poll, they asked people, tell me, they asked a couple of different questions. They said, tell me whether this statement better describes Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, or both of them equally. So I'll give you a couple of examples. They asked people, who do you think treats people with respect and dignity? Hillary Clinton, 52% of people said Hillary Clinton treats people with respect and dignity. Only 15% of people said Donald Trump does the same thing. Another example of reverse, 28% of people said Hillary Clinton is a tough negotiator. 46% of people said that Donald Trump is a tough negotiator. But this was really my favorite. They asked people, who's more honest and trustworthy, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? And 41% of people said neither.
Ooh.
So there were more people who said that neither of them are honest and trustworthy than agreed that one or the other is more honest and trustworthy.
But in a way, you can almost see why that result would come up, just thinking back to what we would hear people say in the run-up to the New Hampshire presidential primary and the results that we got in that, where people were saying, look, we're just sick of all the politicians, and if they're now including Donald Trump, the likely Republican nominee, as a political figure, they're just saying, look, I just don't trust all of them. And so you could see how a number would get that high.
You can see that. And I think that's a really important topic, because what's going to really win this election will be turnout, right? There are 10 to 15% of people who are undecided, but then there are Democrats and Republicans, and you know these people are in your camp. And so you have to drive these people to the polls if you want to win. And especially for Donald Trump, he needs to make sure that he does better than John McCain. He needs to make – if the Republican Party wants to make sure that they not only win the state, but think about all the down ballot races, all the way down to the House of Reps, they need to drive turnout. Trump needs to get in the high 40s if this state is going to if Republicans are going to keep the House and Senate. So this is incredibly important.
Dean, we keep coming back to this conventional wisdom question of, you know, can the party unify with Trump as its likely nominee? And I don't know if this is an appropriate parallel, but I mean, we did see at the start of this two-year legislative session, we saw a schism between two factions of Republicans in the state House, and it resulted in some of those Republicans joining with Democrats to elect Speaker Jasper instead of William O'Brien, who was the Republican caucus's nominee. But you didn't hear a whole lot of dissension in the ranks, at least not in public, between those two factions of the state House Republican caucus. So maybe this idea of, you know, can the party come together is just a question that comes up from time to time and maybe isn't necessarily going to be, or maybe it is.
Yeah, and you know, I think at some level are the kind of the relationship between our Democratic governor and a Republican state legislature has been functioning at a level that we're just not seeing reflected in the national level in Congress, where there have been tremendous problems in moving forward on anything. And I think you'll hear that in Governor Hassan's bid to run for Senate, talking about, bipartisan success, et cetera. The bigger issue of whether or not the parties are going to unify, you know, what I typically see is as we get through the conventions and into the summer and then the general election, general election psychology takes over, in which people in one party say, hey, anybody from our party is better than the person from the other party. And they get very good at kind of rationalizing away things that kind of provide cognitive dissonance in their minds about, you know, whether it's a kind of a Muslim ban or, you know, the future of Obamacare among Democrats, what have you. That's what happens. We're seeing it happen very quickly among Republicans, where they're falling in line behind Trump. And he really hasn't sort of made any kind of big changes or distinctions based upon where he was just a few weeks ago. I think we'll see that as well to some extent with the Democrats once we get into the general election season. But that seems to be a little more tenuous right now, as, you know, Bernie Sanders is still competing and drawing crowds to his events.
And to come back to something you said as we started this part of the conversation, Casey, the idea of the U.S. Senate candidates in this state essentially tying themselves or trying to tie the other to those national figures. It's going to be interesting to see how much of a New Hampshire race we actually wind up having. How many of the New Hampshire issues wind up being discussed, or does it all really just wind up falling against that backdrop of the presidential election?
Yeah, I think, you know, inevitably, especially in the Senate race, you're going to see, I think, a big push to kind of nationalize it, particularly because one of the things that's been talked about is just the kind of contrast in foreign policy between Governor Hassan, Senator Kelly Ayotte. Senator Ayotte, obviously, just by virtue of being in the U.S. Senate, has a little bit more national exposure on that issue. So I think you're going to see that further elevate the conversation to a more national level than it might have been otherwise.
Yeah, one interesting additional insight from my conversation with Governor Hassan is on this issue of foreign policy. And, you know, we asked her about the fact that, you know, Kelly Ayotte very quickly adopted a high profile in foreign policy. She was kind of mentored by John McCain and Lindsey Graham in the Senate. And so what was her reaction to that? And she immediately switched to talking about Trump's foreign policy or lack thereof, and that Kelly Ayotte, by virtue of being a Republican who says she'll support him, it's no longer about McCain and Graham. It's about Ayotte and Trump. So, you know, A, she gave me a very impassioned defense of Hillary Clinton, and B, she very quickly linked Kelly Ayotte to Donald Trump. So that's going to be the way it's going to, at least on the Democratic side, that's what you're going to hear.
So maybe that old axiom, all politics is local, isn't always the case.
Somewhat local, I guess.
Something like that. Well, our local area code, by way of a transition here, is 603. And we learned this week that area code will stay in place for the whole state for years to come. Joining us now with more is David Brooks. He reports for the Concord Monitor and writes the blog at granitegeek.org. He's been writing about the future of area code 603 this week. Hi, David.
Hey there.
We know that area codes help route phone calls from one part of the country to the other and have been a part of our phone system for decades. But the story of how New Hampshire ended up with this particular area code 603 itself is pretty interesting.
I'm glad you say that, because I find area codes weirdly fascinating. So the area code system was set up, existed right after World War II, as we were transitioning away from human operators, and they had to figure out a system by which, you know, the machines would know where to send the call. And part of it was area codes that were sort of handed out by geography. And as I mentioned in the column, part of the numbering system was they actually try to give these smaller numbers to the more populous places, so that the old dials, remember, you used to have the dial and number, you'd have to wait for the dial to go back again. They wanted that to take up as little time as possible. So New York City got 212 because that's the smallest possible one you could do. We got 603, and an O, of course, is 10, so that's a total of 19 clicks on the dial, which indicates that we're sort of a small state. It was handed out, and it was turned on in the late 40s, and because New Hampshire was small enough, the whole state was covered by 603.
Now,
and it's been that way ever since.
There's seven digits in a phone number, with a few exceptions. Each one of those digits can be between 0 and 9. That seems like plenty of combinations for a state of, you know, a million and change. Yet there was talk a number of times that we would run out of numbers. So help me make sense of what was going on there.
Right. They came out. There's this organization called the North American Numbering Plan Administration that handles it for Canada and the U.S., Mexico, and the Caribbean. And you're right. There should be almost 10 million phone numbers available within 603, and we only have 1.5 million people. The problem is, based on the way the technology used to work, and to a certain extent still does, for the way telephone switches actually exist, they have to sort of hand out those numbers in blocks. And they used to hand them out 10,000 at a time. So you'd get an exchange like, you know, 672 in my town, for example, and then there's the four digits after that, which is the equivalent of 10,000 numbers. All of those would get handed out at once, but there might not be 10,000 people wanting phone numbers. So a lot of those numbers would sit unused. And that is what led the North American Numbering Plan Association in 1999 to say 603 was running out of numbers, and we were going to have to get a new area code, a second area code in New Hampshire. People freaked out. It really showed you that how much 603 was sort of part of the state identity, the fact that we all had the same area code. People really liked it. It was sort of like, you know, the old man on the mountain kind of thing.
Well, you found that there were a number of businesses, for example, that used 603 in their name or in their branding, so it wasn't just a prefix for phone calls.
Right. You betcha. And we all know that. I mean, if you can't get Granite State in your name, and you know, you put the old man on the mountain outline, but you also get 603, there's, and the one I had a picture of in the paper was a brewery, a fairly new brewery in London area, and they wanted to be New Hampshire branded, so they chose 603. But there's all sorts of companies that there's bars and there's consultants, there's lawn care companies, and there's something called 603 Strippers, which I didn't go investigate on the company computer because I thought maybe I better not.
Two things come to mind about this. One is that whoever came up with the term number conservation measures, I think, deserves an award because that was actually in some of the reporting this week. And also something to keep in mind with this, cell phones use area codes. They're part of the phone system, but they're not necessarily tied to a physical location. So
yeah.
I know people who live in New Hampshire but have California area codes,
yep,
or New York or D.C. or wherever it is.
And voice over IP calls, you get it through Google Voice or something, that doesn't necessarily have a New Hampshire area code either. So there actually are, you're right, thousands of people living in the state that do not have a 603 area code. And I think over time, partly because technology is allowing these blocks of phone numbers to be divided up more and more, divvied up better, which is part of the reason why we haven't run out of numbers. And I think over time, cell phones and voice over IP calling and other things is gonna, are going to make area codes less and less important. So, 30 years from now or something, a brand name of 603 may not mean much to youngsters then. But right now, it definitely just still does. And it's nice to hear that we're gonna stick with 603 as our only area code through at least the year 2032 is what we are now told.
Well, David Brooks of the Concord Monitor and GraniteGeek.org, thanks so much for joining us, and especially, appropriately, by phone.
It is indeed, but it's a cell phone, so I'm not even quite sure what the area code is.
Trent, I know this is an issue foremost on your mind.
Well, I just wanted to say, David, I hope you're still there. This is Trent. I just wanted to say that I read your story over Cheerios earlier this week, and I want to say thank you. You literally answered every single question I've ever had in my life about area codes.
Well, I got to tell you, I heard from phone geeks, and they said, well, why didn't you talk about this, and why didn't you talk about that?
Of course. You can't please everybody, I guess.
No.
David, thanks so much.
You bet.
Quickly, what will each of you be covering next week? I'll start with you, Dean.
The elections. I'm going to be having a conversation with Mark Connolly, who's a Democratic candidate for governor, and just be following all the races develop.
Trent.
Everyone should pick up today's paper. I've lived here a long time, but the advertising department did an incredible job of putting together the top 10 things to do in New Hampshire, and there are a lot of things I really learned there. In terms of news next week, we're going to be following up on mental health. Two police officers shot in Manchester, and we want to see how mental health played into that.
And Casey?
I think I'll also just continue to kind of keep an eye on these last-minute moves at the State House and other kind of emerging issues on the political front, too.
Well, big thanks to each of you for joining us for the New Hampshire News Roundup. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Brady Carlson.